Hello, listening people.
Hello, 400.
Hello, Bartek. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ryan. How are you, 400?
I am doing 400th. This is our 400th time saying hello, listening people. I don't think we've ever skipped a listening people hello.
It's the most important part of the episode.
That is the most important part, yeah. Next to, obviously, when we say, remember to be kind to each other, and then...
And that time you called them superfluous.
One time. Only once did Bartek pick up on it.
Mm.
The other times, skated on by.
I let them down so many times until I didn't.
That's it, until you didn't. We've been on many adventures here on Spit and Polish Presents. We have now gotten up to our 400th episode of the podcast, and on this podcast we talk about a variety of things, mainly movies, but over the years we have talked about video projects that we have found, we have talked about TV shows that we have liked, and currently we are doing Pictures Powwow, in which we talk about movies that come recommended. When we first started, we used to do audio commentary tracks. We did those for a while.
Yeah, 161 episodes.
We covered them. They were unappreciated masterpieces, films that fit a certain mold and certain feel. And it was always kind of hard to describe to people who had never listened to the podcast or hadn't been on it.
I remember.
What is an unappreciated masterpiece? And then, like, when you list a few of them, even though they're different years, different films, different target audiences, there's a certain quality to them where you're like, yeah, I see what you mean by unappreciated masterpieces.
I have a friend, it was actually Steven, who came on for the Tekken episode. When I told him, you know, the types of movies we did, it's like, oh, stuff that I used to watch.
Stuff that you used to watch, or things that you knew existed in the world that perhaps you didn't. And I bring all of this up because we're going to be talking about a film that was always on the agenda for unappreciated masterpieces. It's always skirted around. There were a few of these films over the course of the pod that we always said, that would be a good one, or I'm aware of this one, that would be good, or maybe a guest would say, oh, this would be a good one, and we would note it down or mentally put it in our brain there and just say, lock it away and say, maybe one day, and then we didn't get to these. So for the 400th, we always, with a big celebration, we like to get a guest in, if possible, and we talk about a Paul Giamatti film, if possible, too, because he's our special little guy.
Yeah, last time it was Shoot 'Em Up.
And this is the film that came directly after Shoot 'Em Up. I didn't mean that. It was just by happenstance. But we're joined by my wife, Rachel. Hello.
Hello, listening people.
Host of Hello. Yum Yum Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing?
Okay.
Did you know when we first started this podcast, you and I were not married?
Yes, I was aware of that.
Did you know if our relationship had failed, we would have had audio recordings of it succeeding? Mm-hmm. Think about that. I think about that type of thing a lot when you have people who are in relationships and they do content.
Misleading wording, Bill. I know what you mean.
You know when people have like relationships and they have content and you're like, when the relationship fails or breaks away, and
the
then
content is evidence of why.
Yeah, or evidence of what worked, and you go, "What happened?"
It's just like they were happy at one point. Look at this vlog.
Hey, everyone, go listen to the Man of the House episode where we talk about potatoes,
and you can hear Rachel contemplate divorce, and we weren't even married by then. In all fairness, Bartek was the one riling up Rachel a good amount in that too, where you were
siding
with
me. The potato thing
me.
Was innocent. I was like, "Oh, how do I describe this color of yellow? I guess mashed potatoes."
But, Rachel, instead of talking about potatoes, how about you tell us what film you pitched our way?
Well, this was not a pitch for Pitches Powwow.
And this was a Ryan recommendation anyway.
But Rachel was always saying, you should do this movie, and
no,
I would love to talk about it. And I said,
was
okay,
like,
okay.
Nanny Diaries is a ridiculous movie that has Paul Giamatti in it as a creep. And you were like, ooh, gotta save that for the pod.
And then you said, it'll be a good one to talk about. I would love to chat about that one. And then I kept saying, okay.
I was just like, oh, I think you'll drag me on for that, right? Because it's a chick flick. It's a Giamatti. So.
And you just loved it. You would talk about it outside of the podcast over the years. It's like, remember the Nanny Diaries? Like this thing.
That was a weird movie. But, like, I remember it being, like, an easy watch that was very forgettable from, like, the moment that it was finished.
I beg to differ, but we will discuss it. Rachel, how would you pitch The Nanny Diaries to someone who hasn't watched it, but you're trying to recommend it to them?
I'm trying to recommend it? Then I guess that does change the way that I might present some things. So.
You already said Giamatti creep. I'm sold. Give him the Oscar.
We like Giamatti variety.
Recent college graduate decides to do a summer of nannying for the Fifth Avenue parent in New York, and it satirizes New York's elite.
And hijinks ensues. Chris Evans is here being a hunk. Scarlett Johansson is here playing a woman who's supposedly not attractive, but I couldn't help but notice.
A little bit of everything. Like, we have the romance, we have friendship drama, we have some family drama, we have some, class warfare.
Could I ask you this? You just said it's a little bit of everything for everyone. Would you classify this as a masala film?
I'd love to see the Bollywood version of this film.
Giamatti's still in it.
There is a scene where they do dance.
Wow. Rachel nailed it.
Yeah, there are one or two parties.
This is a masala film. We've done that. If you don't know what masala is, listen to our last episode. Bartek, now we're here to talk about The Nanny Diaries in details, yeah, and spoilers Huna and all. Could you tell us your history with The Nanny Diaries? Had you seen this before? Are you familiar with this? Did you know anything about it? Are you a lover? What's your deal?
I hadn't seen this before. I actually think I haven't seen anything that has the word nanny in the title, because whenever someone mentions, anything that has that word
no
in the title.
Nanny McPhee?
None, no.
No, The Nanny starring Fran Fine?
No. So
finds her character.
Basically, every time someone mentions something with the word nanny in it, I think it's like a reality show or something. Because I think my mum once watched a reality show about nannies.
Like Super Nanny?
I think maybe that was it. Yeah.
It's always weird what you define as a reality show. Because, when I think of a reality show, I think of, your Big Brothers, those type of reality shows, or, your type of, things. But the ones you're talking about, your Super Nannies, I'm like, yeah, they're technically a reality show, but they're the ones where it's, I guess you could say, they're the same type of reality show as an episode of a gardening show is a reality show, where it's technically you're going to people's houses to fix their gardens. Would you call that a reality show? Well,
a non-fiction show,
there you go. Documentary.
Documentary.
Would you call A Weird Weekends with Louis Theroux a reality show?
That's fair, yeah.
I always think about, what counts and what doesn't.
What would you call Wife Swap, then?
Yeah, but that's the thing, though. Again, there's a
wide spectrum. No, I'm just asking because, does that fit on your...
On my spectrum? Again, I think that one's harder because there's an inherent game quality to it.
Mm.
Well, something like Super Nanny, it's like, what happens if we sent a woman to a person's house that's filthy?
No.
And they just judge them. Is that not Super Nanny?
No, that's a different show.
There's too many of them.
I think that, I feel there was a show like that that was literally called, How Dirty Is Your House or something, because my mum used to watch that as well. Super Nanny was when it's just, parents are struggling to parent their kids, so they sign up for a reality TV show, and this, I want to say British, she has a distinct accent.
I feel like it was someone British,
Who's, the super nanny who knows how to deal with the most difficult children and
was one of them a kid
get them
with,
to be behaving children that are respectful and do what they're told.
I think that's exactly what
and
I remember.
And was one
yeah.
of the kids a boy with explosive farts to the point in which he could power a rocket? And her solution was to hand him off.
What is this, 398 episodes ago?
I haven't watched every episode of Super Nanny.
Well,
so
if you watched a film called Thunderpants, you would know.
I do know that there is... I watch Superpants. What the fuck are you talking
You watched Superpants, did you? Don't you say you watched something and then get the title wrong? So we're here to talk about The Nanny Diaries.
I watched Thunderpants.
With Paul Giamatti.
And I am sure that in Super Nanny, there were children
who farted,
who aggressively farted.
Mm. Well,
and that's my history.
And my history, my history with the Nanny Diaries is very simple, but I think it's one that we can all relate to. You often hear, you know, especially from our American guests that we've had on the podcast, when you or on TV shows, oh, I used to go to the video rental store and I'd see that cover, or I'd see that poster, or I'd see that trailer on the little TV. I had that kind of, my mother works in a retail store, and so when I would wait for her to knock off, I'd go to the DVD sections and
mm-hmm.
I'd organize the DVDs, and because they were like, you know, ooh, the ones in the buckets or the, you know, like in the tubs or whatever, and they were messy. I'd organize them. In the bargain bin, and I'd look at them, and there'd be a couple that you would see over and over again. Nanny Diaries was one of them. And I'll get them confused with another film that I forgot to look up, where it's a film with Toni Collette. There's a film with Toni Collette where she wears these glasses, and I always thought she was Tina Fey because she looks extremely like Tina Fey. And I'd see that in the Nanny Diaries. They had a similar poster, similar design, similar like mood of a film where it's like, I don't know for a fact that these are the same type of movie, but you get the aura of it. And so the Nanny Diaries was always one where you see the poster of it and it's Scarlett Johansson sitting there and she's on the writing, and it looks very cutesy. And that's what I thought. It's a cutesy film. Oh, this is a cute film. Rachel likes it, so it's going to be a cute film. But then also, I have an appreciation for these type of movies. Hence, we do many of them on the pod, especially from the 2000s, which is when we grew up, where there were just a variety of hard-to-label-what-they-are movies.
Mm.
What category do you put this in type films? And I joked about masala films a moment ago, but like the Nanny Diaries is definitely one of those where it's like, we were watching it last night and it's like, it has so many different things it's going for and trying to achieve. It's so many different tones, so many different switches that it's hitting. And like, it reminds me of stuff of like Confessions of a Shopaholic is a great companion.
I was basically thinking of the whole way through.
And that's a film that hits a variety of subject matters and tones. Now, Rachel, you were the one that brought this up. So when did you see this? When did you first watch this? And what have been your relationship over the years?
I think I may have watched it in like 2008, I want to say. I think I watched this for the first time renting it through like cable TV.
Oh, wow.
I think that's how I first watched it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it was like I watched this and The Devil Wears Prada around the same time. And I remember like I paid like $5 to rent The Devil Wears Prada through Austar.
Now, were you a lover of it, though?
I remember having a lot of fun with it. And I remember being like, that was fine. Like, that was fun. It was very forgettable but digestible. And I was just like, and now I'm never going to really think about that again.
But you've never stopped thinking about it. You brought it up over the years.
There were a couple of scenes that stuck out. But I am surprised that I basically forgot the framing device of the movie. The scene that I remembered most is like 2 seconds long. Like it's ridiculously short, but it's when the mum is holding the kid up in the steamy bathroom being like, I think he
helping
has
the kid.
I think he has croup.
Croup, yeah.
Croup. Apparently I just cannot say things correctly this episode.
Welcome to Pictures Powwow. Bartek, the Bicentennial Man, lived for, was it 2 years?
I accidentally said, yeah. It's an epic that covered 2 years.
I remember that, and I remember the Paul Giamatti throwing a puppy at Scarlett Johansson.
It's like his last scene.
That was amazing. Like, those are like the scene. Two moments that stood out to me.
We should have like some sort of GIF animation just of those two scenes back to back.
Of course. I want to blend it with one of his other movies, like Shoot 'Em Up or something.
Mm.
Just for everyone to know, you're on the edge of your seat. The Toni Collette movie I was referencing from my childhood that I've never watched, but I think we will watch for the pod, is called In Her Shoes,
mm-hmm.
starring Cameron Diaz.
I loved and that movie it's, so much. We have that on DVD still, I think.
And here's the saddest thing. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes long, which is an insane length.
That's
for a film.
Nothing.
But Bartek, your favorite
look
thing.
Look up who the grandma is.
Excuse me. It's Shirley MacLaine. And your favorite thing, Bartek, mm-hmm. the poster, unironically, is the Empire Records poster.
Mm.
There's a random dog on the poster for no reason on the side
of
the couch.
No, there are dogs in this movie.
Well, that's
there
fine.
There are dogs in that movie.
The Nanny Diaries.
The dogs are important.
Bartek,
yeah, Ryan, there are dogs in it.
Bartek, it's our 400th episode.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Giamatti special. I preface that he's not in this movie too much, but he's in it. And we always have a thing about Paul Giamatti, big or small roles. He always lights up the screen for us. He was always ecstatic. So I just wanted to, for both of us,
mm-hmm.
to get out of the way our Paul Giamatti thoughts and then go into what we thought of the movie. So could you please tell me your Paul Giamatti thoughts and your initial
you
thoughts
on
the film?
I thought you would want to do the opposite of
because he's not in the movie too much. Mm. And I want to give
the
film
stuff to last.
There's other things, thank you. Maybe Bartek will
but
tell
like
us that he's a big
Giamatti
Chris Evans fan.
The Giamatti discussion is what you wanted to do this film for.
Of course, he's always the key, and we'll always come back. But I want to know the...
We're so excited, I didn't even think we've explained what Pictures Powwow is.
I said movie recommendations,
yeah.
So...
Well, much like a fish in the sport of fishing, you throw out your line with some bait on it and you just, you know, want to go get that bait. You know, I'm empathizing with the fish, obviously. He doesn't appear straight away. And when he finally enters the film, he is physically withheld from us in a way.
His face. He has a face reveal.
Yeah.
But his voice isn't. Withheld from us. And he's doing an accent in this one. He's doing a funny little accent. Immediately I was like, what's this voice he's doing?
Yeah.
Is it
It's a business.
New York?
You know what it is? He wishes that he could have been in the Annie movie as Daddy Warbucks. That's what this performance is him being like, I'm old businessman, angry man. He's doing a weird voice, but
I wish
he
was in Black Annie.
He was withheld.
And they put a twist on him, too. In his first scene, he seems like, oh, finally a cool guy in this kid's life. And then, ooh, no, he's not a cool guy. And as the film goes on, you know, much, much less of a cool guy than even that.
But outside of the summary that he's actually revealed to be a pretty nasty figure, like, he's genuinely gross in this. Like,
yeah.
It's hilarious to think that he came off of, like, around the same time he was doing Shoot 'Em Up, where he's also a creep, but
well,
it's like a
villain,
fun
yeah.
creep.
Mm.
In this one, it's not fun when he's doing that, but also there is, in my eyes, a little bit of humor had, because Paul Giamatti has such a bizarre energy. And in this one, what I think was really unique in comparison to the usual Giamatti was it was dripping with not just anger and resentment, which is overt, but apathy. There's like this apathy, like when he's hitting on Scarlett Johansson at the end, it's almost like his character and Paul through the performance is doing it as if it's through, like going through the motions, like, oh, I have to,
she's here,
like when he touches her hair.
I don't have any orange juice, so I might as well grope her.
Well, I'm stuck at this house now, so yeah. There's
and
a woman.
And his default defense when he is like caught in that moment, he's like, he's not even trying. And he's going to win. He's going to get away with it.
It reminds me of a couple of episodes when we did the Count of Monte Cristo when Guy Pearce was found out to be cheating. He's like, oh, that's actually kind of a relief.
But what did you think of Paul in this?
I loved seeing this side of him. It was very different, especially since, you know, a couple of months ago, as of this recording, we saw him in The Holdovers where he also played a bit of an asshole, but there was like a warmth to it.
While here.
He was an asshole for a very different purpose and context, like in a very different context in The Holdovers.
Yeah.
I loved him.
Mm.
Of course I did. I love that they withheld his face and that it was a dramatic reveal and that when they revealed him, It's the freakiest he's ever looked. His hair is so short.
You were obsessed with his eyes.
I was obsessed with the eyes. I don't know if you felt this, but especially when he had his little round glasses on, I couldn't tell if they put contacts in his eyes or something. They were so bulgy, but like this weird, sickening blue. And then I looked up Paul Giamatti. He does have blue eyes from what I could tell. Although if you Google Paul Giamatti eyes, you're going to get nothing but the holdovers now, because a lot of the articles were about how did they do that with his eye.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
The wacky eye. But I couldn't help but notice his eyes are so fucking weird in this movie. And it's just because everything's about him is physically weird. Like, he's got a clean-shaven face, which isn't unusual, but the short, short hair where he's basically bald at the back of his head. Paul Giamatti's always had, like, a balding quality, but, like, this is the most I've seen of him, unless he's been directly shaven entirely, which I think I've seen once or twice, maybe. But, like, yeah, of course, I've seen The Amazing Spider-Man too. But I was just so thrown off, and like the fact that they were slow teasing us the reveal, and like we don't know his name because of the framing device, he's Mr. X, and he's just so angry, and yet I was laughing so much every time he came on the screen, because by his very nature he's in a different movie. Like,
he's,
his character's,
he's
like,
not a cartoon in this one.
Yeah. He's a character that's in the film Wall Street, and he keeps coming back into the fucking Nanny Diaries.
Into the chick flick.
Like, he's the one that's in The Wolf of Wall Street. He's in one of those kind of, like, high-octane, stressed dramas where the people are doing drugs and business deals and cheating on their wives, but every time he has to come back home, he's in the Nanny Diaries. Like,
see,
that's what I felt with him all the time.
Thinking of them as neighbors of the couple in Carnage.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. That's a great film, too. Now, Rachel, you're not as Giamatti-centric as Bartek and I, but you're married to me. You hear about him all the time. Hear us talk about him. You've been on podcasts with the... actually, have you been on a podcast with us where Giamatti's been in a film? I'm trying to recall if we've had Rachel for a Giamatti movie.
I don't think so.
Maybe this is your first.
I think we mostly get Will on.
We mostly get Will or Lauren on, but what are your opinions any further on the G-Man in this?
He's awesome. He's very successfully a creep. You know, very, yeah, that's what these men are like.
You know the scene in the car where it's, I think it's the scene where we see his face for the first time, how the kid's screaming because he wants the business card.
Yeah.
And Paul Giamatti gives him like a new card and he throws it away because like, I don't want this one. Does that kid not know how many of us would kill to have that card?
I would kill to have that card. It's probably the same car as well that Marty Wolf was in when he met when Frankie talked to him.
Wasn't that a limo?
Yeah, it was a limo.
Wasn't this a limo too?
No.
I can't. It's a fancy car. I look at fancy cars and think they're all the same. Now, I must say, too, that we had a lengthy discussion a couple of times on this pod about, is Paul Giamatti an actor? That we look at him and, like, there's a dissonance there, because I think of him as a respected actor, like an actor with great reputation, prestige. He's a dramatic actor, but he can be funny and he can be silly, but, like, overall, and then we see him in these movies and he's hamming it up, and he's utilizing all of his skills as an actor for quote-unquote evil.
And I mentioned that I mostly started paying attention to him once we started the podcast, so this is, you know, that's kind of more normal for me.
And I would say all of the stuff is still on offer here in this film, but I would argue that this is probably the most dramatic role we've seen him do on the pod that's the least, like, humorous for, like, campy reasons or ironic reasons, or just to see him chew up the scenery. He still does the Paul Giamatti yelling and he looks like a freak in this, but like, what are your thoughts on that, Bartek, on this idea of, like, we've had this ongoing conversation about, like, the realization that Paul Giamatti maybe is a bit more of a scamp than people give him credit for, but now we come into a film like this which is fairly lighthearted, but he comes in as a figure that, although can be a bit humorous, really brings another element.
Yeah, well, putting aside the Truman Show, like, this is what, like, the first time where you see, like, this is not a Paul Giamatti movie. I mean, I guess Thunderpants too.
Thunderpants is very small in that, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, this is one where, you know, you could see many other people in this role playing, like, you know, the, maybe not abusive, but, like, the dickhead dad who is cheating on his wife and, as you said, is basically out of The Wolf of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he does it very well.
Mm.
What were your thoughts on The Nanny Diaries?
There was a lot of mixed feelings. Overall, I did like it, but there were, you know, a mix of all these things where it's like, it's very cliche. It has, you know, appropriate for our anniversary, one of our big pet peeves of a lie revealed.
Yes.
But also, it's got some very evocative things from our time doing theatre at university. This film has a lot of very non-naturalistic things going on.
Oh, really?
Quite some artistic stuff that I really enjoyed.
Like? Any highlights?
So Rachel mentioned it before, actually, the framing device of it being like in a museum, and like the museum seems to be this like otherworldly place. You have a moment near the end when they're watching the video and, you know, it transitions to her in the room screaming at all of the mothers, you know, little things like that.
There are some real great flourishes with this. For what Rachel, you said at the beginning, could be considered like a chick flick, you know, throwaway thing that you have ejected from your brain. There is actually quite a lot of interesting technicals on display here.
I still remember that I watched it, which is more than plenty of other chick flick films that I watched around the same time.
But it's no In Her Shoes, your favorite film now, with Toni Collette looking exactly like Liz Lemon from Third Rock.
We have discussed that movie before, and we've discussed how it's just like she's meant to be the frumpy sister, but it's just like
I've seen her in Enough Said.
It's still Toni Collette, so it's like she's not unattractive.
Toni Collette can be frumpy. I've seen Muriel's Wedding. Rachel, what were your opinions on this film now, having to come back, do it for the pod? What was your overall experiences?
What the fuck is this tone?
It's called perfection.
That was like, I was just like, wait, what a bunch. Like, I was like, what is this music choice? Why is this happening now? Oh, that's right. The framing device, that's come back. Great. There was so much more narration than I remembered.
Well, it's a thesis, Rachel.
Yes, it's
no, it's her grad school application to get into anthropology.
It's not even a thesis. It's an application.
It's her smart thing paper.
It's a thing to get her a job.
You should let me into your program for anthropology, and I think it's a failure.
Rachel would fail it, but she's coming from a teaching perspective. Now, if she was a boss, she would hire her, because it's Scarlett Johansson.
As a substitute teacher, I'm more lax.
And as a non-teacher, I look at Scarlett Johansson's panties and I say, hire her.
That underwear was a choice from the wardrobe department.
As an anime fan, I appreciated that homage.
Yes, that's what it was. Homage. Now, I loved it. I love The Nanny Diaries. This is a fantastic film. I loved it. And Rachel said the tone is very much, what is this? It's all over the place. But what I appreciate about this, and we've discussed
the needle
drops
particular.
But I think it gets away with it. And we've gone over this over the years on this podcast. Go back. There are certain things a piece of media can do to flag up early on to, in a way, have a get out of jail free card for its tone. If it declares
Shopaholic did that.
Yes.
A very similar thing.
If it declares what it is up front.
Hmm.
This isn't trying to be a serious, wholehearted version of this story. This isn't the typical like rom-com with Chris Evans and Scarlett Johansson where she has to be a nanny. And I know this because there was a moment within the opening narration where I said out loud, they don't make movies like this anymore. And it was when she was demonstrating the different beauty rituals that women have to go through. And one of them was a woman with anorexia or like bulimia in the toilet.
It's
and
like
I just
fasting
said,
strategies.
Yeah. And I just said, they don't make movies like this anymore. That gag, that joke, that visual, and Scarlett Johansson's line delivery up front told me, I know what this movie is all about. This type of snarky, quirky, out of left field humor and just aesthetic and tone is going to be the film. And then with the narration of the anthropology stuff, it really helps reinforce that. But that was one of those things where I was shocked when it happened. I was also shocked later when Scarlett Johansson dropped an F-bomb in the movie. I was like, whoa, I swear in this. But it all was believable because of that joke at the beginning. If that joke wasn't there with the woman over the toilet, I don't know if I would feel as confident about the movie. And maybe I'd feel a bit more like Rachel was like, what is this? Like, there's so many things being thrown at me. But I always love in a movie when in the first act they give you that lifeline to let you know you're going to go on this type of journey right now. And that was very much, that was it for me, where everything else that went on, like from the truly comedic hijinks that she went through to the dramatic lows to those moments where Lyra revealed and friends lost along the way and friends gained and all of that, I bought it all because of just that one simple little joke put in at the beginning. I was like, okay,
I would extend it to that whole sequence because that told you up front, like, this is the type of movie. This is it's a justification for the narration. It's a justification for, you know, a lot of the stylistic choices, like not giving everyone a name, giving them like a pseudonym. And you have a lot of, you know, the fact that it mentions anthropology up front kind of justified how throughout the film there's a lot of explanations of things. Like, there's a conversation with other nannies where they talk about type A, type B, type C. Like, I think a lot of it was just really complementing that whole anthropological lens that the film's presented through.
And it then further strengthens the class divide system as well, where the echelons of high society do view people in these very black and white ways. Oh, well, if he was truly that sick, then he wouldn't be asleep right now, so it's fine. Thanks, Julie. Judy. You know, that type of thing, like, really goes well into the anthropology narration. And I agree, the whole opening bit really does. It's just that one extra little step with that particular joke. Again, films like that don't get made anymore. Like, The Unappreciated Masterpieces is very much, I guess, a retrospective or a look back, or at least a celebration of these kind of mid-range movies that we don't see celebrities of this echelon do as often. Like, when's the last time you can recall a movie like The Nanny Diaries? Can you recall a movie like The Nanny Diaries within the last, like, 5 years? 10 years? Like, this type of, I guess, chick flick, or where you have like a pretty star-studded cast, like Paul Giamatti, yes, but Laura Linney, Scarlett Johansson, Chris Evans, like, these are people, these are talent, and like, they're here for what you could easily describe as fluff. And I feel like we don't get that now. It's just like, in the highs or lows.
In the age of, and this has nothing to do with this film, Marvel and things like that.
Yeah, two of these people went on to do Marvel. So, Rachel, what is the thing that you want to discuss about
your
Nanny Diaries? You had a question, you had a thought?
My question was, you said that, like, you like when there's a moment that, like, lets you know what the tone of the movie was, and I immediately wanted to know what that is for you for Nothing But Trouble.
Oh, well, that's as clear as day. It's when the Brazilianaires decide that they're going to join the car ride.
Okay, that's what I thought.
That's such a weird thing to do in that movie.
That's what I just wanted clarity on that.
I don't even
moment.
Need to see Vulcanvania to know I'm up. So
yeah,
and then probably after that, the fact that Chevy Chase goes on a on a car chase with the police.
I was going to say
John Candy. Yeah,
only to then not face consequences. But that also only happens because the Brazilianaires egg him on to drive.
Yeah.
It's all about the Brazilian. They're the key to everything. But Rachel, what's something that you want to discuss about the Nanny Diaries? What's something you want to crack on into?
I guess I don't know how, you know, in depth this discussion will be, but I thought that the kid did a pretty good job. Like, as a performance, he does well.
Bartek, you have a bit of a look on your face. What are your thoughts on our little brat?
Just because I haven't really thought about it, but yeah, he did actually do a pretty good job.
Like, he's not distracting. It's just like, it's not like, ugh, child be childing and reading off lines.
Yeah,
he feels like he's performing.
Yeah, like it was. The film I'm about to mention was an unappreciated masterpiece, so it's great. But I was thinking back to Old Dogs. That's a film where Robin Williams is acting alongside two children, and in that one, yeah, they did feel a lot more stiff and like they were reading off scripts. But this one here, he was very emotive. He had pretty damn good chemistry with Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. There was a, you know, immediate, I guess, contrast factor where the first time you see him, he is so warm and like, oh, first impression.
Yes.
And then once she starts working and meets him at the preschool, you know, there is a big sudden shift and you're like, oh, this is giving us a window into like the kind of upbringing that he is a part of. And a lot of the things you learn about his family really well complement this kid's performance. Like you're seeing, there's even a really good line that Scarlett Johansson has where she points out the fact that his, I forget the term, but like with the card that he has, the thing that keeps him calm.
Safety blanket.
Yeah, safety blanket. That's exactly it. How it's like, what does it say about this kid that his father's business card is his safety blanket? And it's like, oh, that says so much right there. And as the film goes on, it perfectly justifies the existence of that card, even though it doesn't get mentioned that often. It's just really good element.
It is an important symbol throughout the film of the emotional neglect.
Yeah, it's consistent.
This isn't a film that goes straight to the lazy route of woman has to look after bratty child. There's so many of those type of movies where the hijinks comes from the child or children being way too crazy and over the top. We've done those films on the pod. That's Betaville, for instance. Like, oh, wacky kids and you can't handle them. And
Alexander's no good.
That's another one. Jennifer Garner does a lot of these type of movies where, oh my, the kid is drawing on the walls and they're pooping, and it doesn't go to that extreme level of it.
No.
It feels like he's a realistic child with also the hijinks of being a
high. He strips himself into his underwear.
Yes, but he's also on purposely being an antagonist to her. Just for that moment, he's testing her out. But I like, again, I don't feel like they went too overboard with the silliness that could come or the strain or drama of the babysitting of a child. It felt pretty grounded and realistic, obviously heightened because it's a movie and because he's a high class, upper class, snooty kid and his parents have their own baggage. But I thought, you know, the performance was really well done. The kid hasn't done too many things over the course of his career. The last film he did was actually on Pictures Powwow, Night and Day. He was a kid at an airport. So
Unappreciated Masterpieces, actually.
Sorry, Unappreciated Masterpieces.
Yeah.
We've done over the years. But I thought the performance was also very good. Yeah. He felt the right amount of precocious, because that's the thing.
He wasn't distracting as a kid performer.
He wasn't a Macaulay Culkin where it's like he's drawing the power to him, which is fair because that's what those movies require.
Yeah, he wasn't a Muniz era protagonist.
No.
Yeah.
No, that's it. He isn't isn't that echelon of it.
No, and that's also isn't what's needed in this film. But I still appreciate that he's good enough that I believe him when he says, like, I love you, Nanny.
Mm.
I have something that I don't feel was as needed. I don't really care for the romance of this movie. It really did feel like an afterthought to me a lot. Chris Evans would pop up and I'd be like, oh, yes, you're here. And in the back half, they would really try to draw out the drama.
They're trying to make it a thing. And it's just like, okay, you're going to do this. But she's just like, oh, I can't have a relationship, so I can't do anything about being attracted to Harvard hottie. And it's just like, well, what chemistry is there? Like,
there was an
they're hot.
Yeah, one of the things that we learn about him in his very first scene never really got developed much. Mm. It was kind of established that he has a sort of brotherly relationship with the kid.
Yes.
But they only interact that one time. And that was a moment that, you know, somewhat brought the kid closer to Annie. So it just feels like, oh, we introduced it in that moment and then never brought it up again.
Yeah, and the mother of the child, Mrs. X, doesn't like him as a presence and tries to not have him interact with the family.
No, but that's also because she doesn't want
the nanny to get with him.
Yeah.
But she also indicates it as a way of, like, this is an ongoing, I don't like him. But I agree.
See,
Bartek brought up a great...
She sees him as a threat.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true too, but, like, Bartek brought up a great point. They introduced this certain quality to him that's never delved into again. And I would say, too, it feels as if it's betrayed because throughout the entire film, he has, like, no, I guess, empathy or sympathy for her
having to raise and manage a child. He just keeps on saying that.
I feel like it went back and forth on it, yeah.
Yeah, because I would feel like, you know, if you introduce in the movie at the very beginning, one of the first things we know about this character is he has a friendly, talkative, bro-like relationship with the child. That kind of gives some play to the concepts of he would kind of have a bit more of an understanding than, say, her best friend.
Mm.
Who, he has the same level of respect and understanding about Scarlett Johansson's position, raising a kid and doing all of this, as her best friend, who's a party girl, who's getting in, you know, in the morning from just having gone out all night and lives in a shitty apartment, then the Harvard hottie, who we established does have a dynamic with the kid.
Like, hey, little buddy, it's your buddy from upstairs or whatever.
Yeah. You know, I actually, great call out there, Bartek, because I completely forgot that they did that and did nothing with it. I didn't care about it because, unlike most of the things in the film, there are other strands that I don't like either, but most of the things in the film, when it comes to Annie, I feel are really layered for a film that is, again, what you could consider a junk film. I can see why this is a favorite for many people, and I loved it. I had a great time. I was laughing throughout. I was feeling the emotions when they were wanting me to. But with certain things, like with him, I don't really feel like I got to not only just know who he is, but I never understood why, other than it is required, there was a romance in the film at all. Mm. I didn't feel the chemistry between the characters. The two actors have screen chemistry, hence they worked really well in the Marvel movies together, and they're both, and I don't say this flippantly, but they're hot. Like, a lot of it is, if you get two attractive people together, it does a lot of the legwork with these type of movies, but I honestly thought it detracted from her story of the stress she had in relation to the hunky boy downstairs. Felt so arbitrarily added to me. Like, when it's like revealed that Laura Linney's character is withholding the phone calls, and that's like one extra level of fuck you from this rich family, I didn't have much of a reaction to that. I was like, okay.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, I mentioned before that this film does play around with some cliches, and with him, a lot of the scenes, I feel like, yeah, they hit them very hard. Like, when you meet him in the bar with his friends, and it's like, oh, his friends are all kind of like douchey, one-dimensional. Like, oh, so you're really hot. You could have a fuck or whatever. Yeah. You know, that kind of character. And you can just see, like, the shock on his face, and then later on apologizing for, you know, my idiot
he's
friends.
He's trying to get them to stop in the scene. So, like, her being pissed off at him feels more contrived than genuine, because he's there, like, trying to manage his friends without being a dick to them.
Mm.
And then she just takes care of the situation herself, which to me is even better than if he successfully stood up for her.
Yeah, she's the token, like, F word.
Nah, fuck you. And really, like, reminds them of who they are. Because
they
feel entitled and they feel above her. And, like, if it was more sort of dynamic in a way of her wondering if that's how he actually views her.
Yes.
But nothing that we see and nothing that he does actually makes it theme that way.
Yeah. To borrow a phrase that we use sometimes on this podcast, it's the I've seen movies phrase. It's you're the love interest in the film who's clearly like charismatic and a good guy. So I know that the way that you are going to, you know, follow up this situation is going to be in a, you know, respectful, kind way that will further your relationship. And then later on when they have the conversation about, like, you don't understand the situation, he brings up his whole backstory. It's like, you know, so I think I do have an idea of what your situation is like.
We're not so different, you and I.
Yeah.
Yeah, which could have been a nice way to, like, connect it back to, like, him sort of bonding with the, not bonding with the kid, but showing a relationship with the kid and, like, trying to get him to, like, see the nanny as a person, because that's something that he would have struggled with maybe as a kid, because he's just like, I had 9 nannies until I was old enough to go to boarding school.
And you could also have the nanny and this guy from downstairs serve as surrogate parent figures. And since you are having him and his group directly be in tandem to Mr. X, that would be strengthened, because she's referring to all of these men as she's seen them, which is through Mr. X. Like, that's where a lot of her resentment and anger comes from in that scene. You're going to become, I see what these type of men are. You are them. You'll be this in 5 years with your balding hair and all that, and your glasses and all that. And here's one of the things too. If this was a film, here's a problem. And this is not a huge issue. We would rather this from time to time. A film that has too many bowls in the air, too many pots boiling, too many plates spinning. Because this is the complaint. This particular strand of it is withered because we just have so many other elements that are being attended to. But if this had more time, and maybe in the book there's more breathing room here, I do not know. But in this scene where he has all of his douchey friends, it should make her question and or you question, is he actually like these guys?
Is he pretending
to be a nice guy to get with her?
Mm.
And if that's the case, you know, you explore that, you unravel that. I've seen movies before that delve into this. Or is he a guy that he has found himself in this situation where he's hanging out with these people and he's trying to be something he's not, and she is the one that sees who he really is?
Mm.
But there's not enough time for either of those. So Chris Evans comes in and out of this movie doing a funny little voice and pretending like, golly gee, I'm just a nice little guy. And I'm like, you're super hot. I know that about you. And so that's one of the things where if you ask me, like, hey, Ryan, what's a story element of this movie that you could do without? That would be the first on the chopping block, because it's nowhere near as engaging to me as the life of Laura Linney's character, Mrs. X.
Yeah, there was a point where Chris Evans was sitting down with her at dinner and, you know, giving her the offer of like, oh, why don't you come with me to, you know, this faraway place and we'll discover ourselves and have a good time. And she's like, oh, but, you know, I've got this obligation. She's like, doesn't what I want matter? Mm. And I remember hearing that and thinking like, yeah, but this plot isn't the thing I'm interested in. So I don't really mind that she's having this problem.
No, it's just like, she was never going to go to the fucking Hamptons with him for a month. And he's just like so casually just being like, I'm just taking a month to just figure out if law school's really for me.
And
it's just like, okay, so you're getting to go to your family's holiday home where you're not going to pay for a fucking thing to figure out if you really want to become a lawyer. Okay.
Yeah.
And no shred of no shade of, oh, privilege, it's a burden, which would be very different if that was a scene that was filmed in a movie for like 2024.
Oh, or even back then, it's just about you put the emphasis on the thing. We know how these things go, but you can't just skate on by assuming that the audience understands the beats of these without actually giving us the stuff itself. You know, I'm a guy in his 30s. I'm watching this with my wife, and to say that the thing that I found the most riveting and the most relatable and the most harrowing is Mrs. X as a character, And it's because they give her so much material. They gave her so many things to like do, and the contradictions and the sadness and the hysteria and the humor and the anger. She's like the
main figure in the anthropological study.
Yeah, and the bits in this movie where it's like, fuck you, you don't know what it's like to be me, actually rings true when she says it, because we have seen her as such a roller coaster of a character. We've spent time with her, but like on paper, the thing that should be the easiest for me to connect to is the romance of the guy and the girl, because I know what that is. I've seen that before. I've lived that. I know this. I don't know from personal experience, and I don't watch too many movies that deal with the problems and the woes of a philanderer and his rich wife. But that's why movies like this are really great, because they can transport you to things that you aren't familiar with and you think that you wouldn't care about. Like, I would complain about how every character in this movie, outside of one or two, I don't give a fuck about because they're rich.
I was watching this movie and I was like, I don't know how Ryan will feel about this, because usually when we have a film that centers around a lot of like rich people...
And they're woe is me.
Woe is me, yeah. You would very often sum them up as rich assholes. Like, I remember when we did Incoherence last October, you summed up the whole cast as like, they're just rich assholes.
And that definitely is the case here, but the film knows it's the case and is examining it and saying, beyond classism, beyond this, women struggle. Scarlett Johansson's a woman. She's struggling in all of these ways.
And the mum says basically that. Mm-hmm. In a way of like, you have more opportunities, but like, because we're women, there's limitations. And that's sort of echoed in different aspects of the plot and specific lines of dialogue as well, of like, nobody gets it right.
And I think there's something very powerful too about her anthropological study singling out and othering women. Like, you have the montage at the beginning, it was like, this is the type of woman. She's making them into black and white characters. And that's the point of the Mrs. X character. She becomes layered and deeper and more someone that you can say, I hate them, they do horrible things, but you understand.
There were so many points in this film, like, man, this poor woman, and then she would say something awful, I'm like, oh man, this
woman. Or she would do something that would reflect how rich she is, and you're like, oh,
like, okay. That scene where she comes into her room with, like, the nightgown, and, you know, they're like, having a moment, and then she's like, okay, I'm going now.
I love
like,
that
she actually doesn't want to listen to what her kid's like.
Yeah, it's like the moment, it's like, your kid is so wonderful.
then the whole back and forth of like coming in with the nightie and the lingerie that's clearly Mr. X is having an affair and all that. I love that type of conversation too, because it's a conversation in subtext. They're not actually saying the things, but we know exactly what's going on here. And you feel both angered by Mrs. X for wanting to keep up this facade, but also you feel sorry for her because she doesn't know what else to do.
She made fun of the other woman at the lunch that they went to, where it's just like,
oh, yeah.
She's just like, oh, everybody
Everyone
else?
Saw it coming.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she's doing it.
See, I forgot about that. That's a good point.
And that's what I mean by... That stuff's really good. We could talk about all these elements, but like the romance stuff. Heck, even Scarlett Johansson.
It's there because that's this movie. And it feels like, well, a chick lit book written in like the early 2000s wouldn't not have a romance.
You got to have.
Checking the boxes.
You got to have a guy on the cover who's holding her.
That's what you have the kid for.
That's not the cover.
No,
though.
But I'm saying like I'm saying that type of cover.
The cover is like a white woman with the red umbrella, which is like
Oh, I was going by the cover that was like them watching the French clowns.
Yes.
Like her.
Oh,
the
no,
kid.
Of the book. I'm talking about the book.
Oh, okay. I was talking about the movie.
Yes. Yeah. But I'm talking about both in terms of like the idea of, you know, you have to have the couple on the cover because it tells you this is what this story is.
By the way, the umbrella, that's a clever reference to Mary Poppins, a famous nanny.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you, Bartek. Unironically, I didn't think about that during the
movie. Oh, oh.
I didn't think about that.
Literally, like, floats off.
Oh, I know, but I just was embroiled with so many other things in this. Like, another strand of this that I just didn't care about at all, because it felt like a checklist. This movie's very much like a checklist, like the liar revealed checklist and the love tree. Yeah, this is the mother, like own mother, Scarlett Johansson's mother. There was this amazing
taking
line.
It out of my mouth. Yep.
There was this amazing line where the mother said, "I never lied to you." And I threw my hands up and then said, "I don't know that." Because I haven't felt it.
I had.
No, but like,
I don't know anything about their relationship to understand.
She's too honest. Like, she keeps on, like, she's like trying to push her kid towards certain things so that she has the financial security that she didn't have as a nurse and a single mother.
Yeah.
But it's just like she's paying zero attention to what her kid clearly wants.
And that's like the plot of many other different stories.
Yeah, but it feels weird because it's just like her mom seems put together in so many other ways that it's just like it's convenient that she has this fault because it gives Scarlett Johansson a reason to hide the fact that she's being a nanny.
Here's the thing. The defense of it is implication, subtext. But that's a mask because you say that because it's what's happening in between the scenes. She's in the film so little, and all she's there to do, you know from beat one, she's there for the blow-up scene where eventually Scarlett Johansson's going to have to reveal to her mother. Her mother will find out and you're going to have the blow-up scene.
Mm.
And even then, it's a fairly underwhelming scene.
Yeah.
In my eyes. I thought it was fairly underwhelming. Like, the mother, I thought, handled it relatively well, and to the point in which you then get madder at the fact that our main character lied the whole entire time because
she was just offended.
It didn't really add up to much at all. Like, yeah, this isn't a case of, like, say, in Confessions of a Shopaholic, where you had the parents in that movie and you felt really bad when our main character would fuck them over in any way because they're genuinely supportive, but you know if you fuck with them, if you cut this tie off, it would damage our main character. But in this, she rarely felt the strain of no longer having her mother. She felt more of the strain of not having Alicia Keys in her life.
I had two layers of expectation. One was a long-term one. One was a very immediate one. And the first one related to what Rachel was saying before about how you could see that there was this element of, like, she wasn't really acknowledging what our main character wanted. So I was expecting, like, okay, there's going to be a thread where that gets addressed. And it doesn't really, so I thought, oh, okay. But then in that scene where you have the liar revealed, and I was like, okay, here we go, we're doing the thing. When Mrs. X entered the scene, I'm like, oh, is this what the whole film was leading up to? Like, the moment where these two very different characters meet, and we might have, like, a really great scene where, you know, we can really delve deep into, you know, this character who isn't an employee of Mrs. X is really going to give her a piece of mind, and we're going to see a different side of Mrs. X. I want to see this confrontation. And it didn't happen.
I like the scene, but I like it in isolation. I love how quick it is. Like, if you examine the scene on its own and remove how little the mother is in the film herself or how little development or characterization she has, I really like Mrs. X coming in and having that big and back and forth about, like, oh, well, he mustn't be that sick, it doesn't matter. And her, like, just being an airhead and oblivious and kind of flexing her wealth and her power and just her lack of self-awareness. And you have the mother there, you know, who's lived a completely different life, and she's not going to do the big speechifying back and forth. She's just going to watch this rich person do their thing, and she understands what her daughter has gotten herself into, and she hates it. I really like that. Like, I thought it was really well played, and I think it would still hit very well if we had more sense of longing from Scarlett Johansson for her family. She's more concerned about how she's not getting on a date with the hunky boy or going out with
her mom.
Yeah.
Because, like, her mum pulls out, like all of the night shifts and all of the overtime that I did, it was for you. but
now she's doing it herself, Scarlett Johansson.
I don't get the sense that Scarlett Johansson feels indebted to her mother, or like
sees what her mother did for her, now she's doing it for someone else.
Or like, well, I didn't ask you to, attitude isn't there either, of like, or like, and they don't bring up like her college loans, which I kind of like felt like would be a natural thing, because it's just like she's just finished college and it appears that she went to like a small college in New Jersey, not super expensive, but she likely would have gone into debt for that as well. So like the financial aspects could have been another thing that complicated her relationship with her mother, and maybe another reason why she accepted the job. She's just like, oh yeah, like I get to live in New York and the pay's pretty good, right? And it's just like, I would have really liked for that, because like Mrs. X appears to like stiff her with her final check.
Mm.
If it's like she discovers like early on, but after she's become attached to
a kid.
The kid.
Because you have the whole thing where he makes her make a promise.
Like she finds out that she's getting paid really low.
Especially for like this type of job.
Yeah.
Like she finds out for one of the other nannies and I think they try to do that by the fact that she's not allowed any vacation time, even though she's promised days off. I think that's the equivalent that they're going for in terms of stressing like our character out.
She never gets a day off.
Here's my problem. Even if she got a day off, this is a huge problem. Even if she got a day off, I wouldn't care to see it, because her day off would be to spend time with Alicia Keys, who's a character I don't like, her mother, who's a character I don't care about, or Chris Evans, who's a character I know nothing about. But that's the thing. There are many things I do like. Like I went through with the Laura Lynn, all the family stuff, the nanny stuff, the kid, the stress of being in this high-end job and losing your own autonomy and then finding it in the end. Like, that's the beauty of cinema. There are things that you can love and hate within the same movie, and it evens out into, like, were the sum of its parts better than the whole? And I feel very much like this is a movie of the sum of its parts, and I very much am still in awe of that we had movies like this all the time, and now we don't. When are we going to get another The Nanny Diaries with someone like this, or In Her Shoes with Toni Collette, who, even when she did that movie, was still considered a very dramatic actress, and now here she is schlepping it with Cameron Diaz and Confessions of a Shopaholic, which is like, look, it's zany Aussie talent getting her big Hollywood movie to show off her skill. I miss these type of things. They were not always films made for me. Clearly, this isn't a film made for me, but I'm always open to try to watch films and give them my time and appreciation. And yes, there was a avenue into that because of Paul Giamatti. We love Paul, but I wasn't disappointed with the lack of Paul Giamatti in this movie. I was never actually saying this needed Paul more.
He was there when he needed to be there.
And it's because the strength of the characters and the flourishes within the presentation, such as the narration and those wacky gags and the visuals, while still keeping it consistent. I would never say that this is a zany film. This isn't a Down with Love, say, without such a visually zany. This rode the line really well of having it be this type of crowd pleaser, this type of film that you would say is for women, but also like, how do you pin it down, like its thing? And adding those extra little layers, those extra little spices and herbs of weirdness, without it going like too much into like, this is a wacky over the top. Like, I would never say to anyone that The Nanny Diaries is like a stylistically crazy
so
film.
So does that mean that you don't want more of that trophy wife with the 75-year-old husband?
I mean, that there was an amazing moment, wasn't it?
Jefferson? Jefferson's mom?
I like that the nanny was looking after her.
Yeah,
that's
great.
What made it work.
Yeah,
even more so. That lady Man, they must have been real bummed that Jennifer Coolidge didn't answer the phone for that role. Or Cheryl Hines or somebody like that. Like, she did a great job. That was an amazing scene. And again, remember when movies like this were filled to the brim with these kooky side characters? Like, again, I keep bringing up Confessions of a Shopaholic, but I always think of Wendy Malick's character, who's like the head of like the Shopaholics,
Like the support group.
Support group, and she was still like stealing clothes and being like a little freak. And you're like, yes, I love these.
Well, Isla Fisher, yeah, brought it out of them again.
Yeah, and we always had these. Or like when we did Big Fat Liar, we loved Paul Giamatti, but we loved the whole cast of characters. Mm. And this has
it was a staple of Unappreciated Masterpieces. Was like, oh, who is your favorite character? And would always be like, oh, the trophy wife of this.
What about
film?
That one nanny? Who's like, yeah, I thought it was going to be simple too. And she gives like her tragic backstory mm-hmm. about her parents.
The Jamaican one?
Yeah. And how she came
left
here.
Her
and you're
family
like,
behind.
This is how the job called me or whatever it was.
And you're like, this is like a this is BBC how the job miniseries yeah. drama about immigration
like,
and stuff.
Yeah, that, like that is a serious thing. And,
and it's a joke in the movie.
Ongoing problem. And it's just like, it's very weird.
A lot of the
in the context of the film.
Yeah, a lot of the scenes with the other nannies, like, you know, when there's a whole bunch of nannies together, reminded me a lot of, like, the South Korean films that we watch with the whole, like, class and stuff. Like, especially, like, that first scene where it was the support, well, not the support group, but the scene where it's like, okay, let's air our grievances.
Yes,
and it's
like the review. The
and it's, like, review. Very clear, like, oh, yeah, well, the mothers who are sitting down were dressed well and happy.
And they, all the nannies are having stands.
They can say what they want, and the nannies are like, we can't say anything. Our jobs are on the line.
Yeah, that was good. And that character, too, like, the head of that group, and she played the tape at the end. She was a great character. Loved how she was portrayed. I could not tell what side she was on.
Yeah.
Was she on the side of the nannies or was she on the side of the rich? She was in that gray zone.
She was in the middle, but stupid.
Yeah, but also like at the end, I didn't feel like she was that stupid. Like when she kept playing the tape.
Like, she's like, agreed to air this tape.
Yeah, yeah. But I really love this. I really did. There were some elements that I didn't care for too much. Like, yeah, the lie revealed stuff. It's a given. There's some formulaic stuff, the love story, but the humor, the heart, and the insight to it. This is a film with a commentary to make. It's talking about social issues. It's talking about the gender divide and social divide of class and, you know, all of this stuff. Some of it falls a little flat to me, and I wanted to get your opinion on this, Rachel, and you too, Bartek. You have to sell a movie.
Yes.
You have to sell a movie, and I know that you have to cast certain people, but I always get distracted in there, especially a movie like this, where Scarlett Johansson's so fucking hot, and the movie kind of treats it like she's a dork. Oh, what was her? Like,
yeah,
no one. And like Paul Giamatti takes a whole entire movie to notice that Scarlett Johansson is hot, and I'm like,
yeah,
okay, I know you've
he's
been a bit distracted.
He's not paying enough attention, but even if he's not paying any attention.
Well, he doesn't see her face for most of it.
Yeah, but you don't need to see her face to know she's hot.
Like,
he liked the bum.
No, she's known for having a good booty.
Mm-hmm.
Scarlett Johansson, I've seen interviews where people are like, she's got a good booty.
It, but no.
She's got a sexy voice even.
Yeah, and like even the outfits that they put her in don't really do her any favors, but she's still hot. She's still hot.
Yeah. I just always find that a little bit of a distraction in some of these films where it's like you're trying to be like, she's a down and out, rough and tumble girl from a poor, disenfranchised family
she's
with
meant,
one
like,
parent.
Jersey trash.
And I keep looking at her going,
but
you've never suffered a day in your life.
You haven't.
You haven't gone
it's
through
a
anything.
Classic Jennifer's body.
Yes, yes. No, that's exactly where they're trying to tell me Amanda Seyfried's not hot. And I'm like, you fucking
was that
liar.
Was that also a thing in Cruel Intentions?
Cruel Intentions was Reese Witherspoon's a virgin. You're trying to tell me that? Good luck, buddy. At least that film was way more over the top with everything. But, anything else we want to say?
I have some information about the books.
Yes.
Cool. Oh, yeah, there's sequels.
Yeah.
Oh, of the books. Where were the film sequels?
One. So, they made some changes. So, this is not a book that I have read. I just read about it. It was written by two women who had worked as nannies.
Obviously.
And in the book, she's just called Nanny.
Makes sense.
She doesn't have the Annie name.
Although that was fun.
Yeah.
Especially when Giamatti would be like, Annie! Ha! Nanny! Just, thanks, Paul.
Yeah.
But, I explained the joke.
And then it's like, oh, Mrs. X used her name and then used her own name at the end. So there's that. They changed Harvard Hottie's real name.
He's Hayden in the end, right?
Yep.
Oh, it's Hayden, right.
His name in the book, Ryan.
Me.
Ryan, you were in the book?
I'm Harvard Hottie.
You went to Deakin.
No.
Before I met you. You're a Deakin dummy, like me.
That's true. And is that all of the big changes you want to tell us about?
So, and in the first book, Mrs. X does not leave her husband.
So they're not exes.
They're not exes at the end of book one. And then The Nanny Returns came out after the movie by a couple of years. And she's married to Harvard Hottie.
Mm-hmm.
And they've spent like over a decade together. And he was a part of, I think it was the UN.
Mm-hmm. Like Ryan.
Going around the world, but now they've moved back to New York because they're getting ready to maybe start a family of their own.
Mm-hmm.
But
they need a nanny.
The kid, no longer a kid, 16-year-old, drunk, turns up and she falls into like the role of being like his mother. And mm-hmm. Harvard Hottie's pissed because she's, like, not wanting to get pregnant because she's busy taking care of this 16-year-old.
I wish they made that into a film. I wish they made that into a movie.
But in the second one,
mm-hmm.
we didn't mention that she fakes a pregnancy.
Oh, Laura Linney fakes a pregnancy in the movie. Oh, that was an insane move, by the way. I brought your mother here and we meet Paul Giamatti's mother. Perfect. Character, by the way.
Amazing. We're reading The Devil Wears Prada on the beach.
When we cut to her and she's like pouring booze and you hear them screaming in the background and she makes a comment and you just hear Paul Giamatti like call her a bitch or something. Yeah, and I didn't ask your opinion,
when
bitch.
When she first appears, she's partly in shadow.
Yes, she's like Paul, a mystery.
I actually thought she was a black lady.
Oh, classic Bartek. Mixing up races again on this pod.
So
could you imagine if that was what they did?
Well, that's why I was confused. Like,
in the book, because like it time jumps forward, Mrs. X does have a second son.
Yay.
But Mr. X has left her for a younger woman.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
No.
Yeah. You know that other thing that they keep on like harping on that eventually, like it's going to happen to you.
It happened.
It happened. But the other thing that is revealed about Paul Giamatti's character.
He's uncircumcised.
He's the bird that's in the background.
Rachel did a little pause like she was shocked that me would say that. Have you known me? I always say random shit like this. He is circumcised. He's a helmet head.
How do you know?
Rachel reacted like he was not circumcised.
Well, no. How would she know?
Yeah. No, so what is it, Rach?
He's a con man.
Oh, what?
He's not actually like that successful at business.
He is his character from Shoot 'Em Up.
He is a con man.
Oh, okay.
He is Marty Wolf, actually. Yes, this is the closest hairstyle to Marty Wolf.
He's a big fat liar.
Well, is this hairstyle he has, I guess, closest to Thunderpants? We had really short hair in that, but it was more than this.
Maybe, yeah.
But that is The Nanny Diaries. Filled to the brim with the things we love to see on the pod. 400 episodes we've done for this. And it's always great that we can keep bringing up these type of these type of movies to discuss. Like, it's a never-ending thing, and yet also it feels like there's an end point to it, because we don't get enough of these unappreciated masterpieces in this way, but there is always more out there.
I'm glad that this episode almost felt like kind of a throwback.
I thought that would be what would be needed, because when I mentioned that Paul Giamatti's not in this one too much, you had a little bit of a, oh, okay.
Yeah,
why are we doing this now?
I think you
I'm getting a big boy Paul.
I think you phrased it something along the lines of, like, he's the father of one of the kids or something. And you had that really early scene where, like, a bunch of different women gave the business cards. I'm like, oh, okay, she's going to be running around a few different kids. But that didn't end up being
the
case.
And then I said he was Mr. X.
I must say one of the, like, it was not even a joke. It's a choice of prop that I adored.
Yeah.
No, not the nanny cam bear. When, like, Harvard Hottie's reading out the letter that he's been given, and it cuts to Mrs. X and the kid on the bed. And he's reading a book and she's reading a book. Did either of you notice what the title of the book she was reading was?
No.
I think I tried reading the title, but I couldn't.
I'm pretty sure it said How to Raise a Gentleman.
Oh.
And I was just like, oh, she's giving a fuck.
No.
Like, she's not only spending time with her kid, she's reading to try and, like, learn how to actually be a parent, because she hasn't been bothered. And the other thing that I wanted to mention was, being far removed from American contexts.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why the fuck do they care so much about their six-year-old not getting into a motherfucking college? Like, why are colleges accepting six-year-olds?
Patek? Do you have an answer? You read a lot of anime.
Yeah, I'm an American.
I said you read a lot of anime. That's what I said. And you just said, yeah, I'm an American.
Yeah, that's the kind of conversation you come
to. Americans, answer the question. My final note. And
like,
then,
I get it, because they're rich, they're entitled. Like,
yeah, like a special program
or
something.
It's a whole different process. But also, like, it's not even like one of the Ivy League colleges that they're going after.
Well, we'll never know.
That's why you have to go to that museum that's in her mind.
That's why I downgrade the film.
In the credits, they do acknowledge, like, the, like, place that they used for, or, like, modeled those windows after.
Mm. That's nice. Now, I have one final thing, and then we're going to hear what the listening people's recommendation. It's Rachel's going to pitch a film our way.
Coolio.
Maybe we'll have Coolio starring in it. I don't know. Do not know. But Laura Linney has been mentioned a bunch. She's an actress of note. She's been in many things over the years.
I was about to say, she was in The Truman Show, wasn't she?
Yes. And she's reunited with Paul yet again. Now, I always think of Laura Linney nowadays for one thing in particular. One of our early guest spots on another podcast was for The Contrarians, in which we did The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, the original 1940s film starring Danny Kaye and Virginia Mayo.
Mm-hmm.
And the host of that show, one of the hosts, Julio, tried to bait me by being like, oh, this actor's like this modern actor. Wouldn't you agree?
There was something about Marvel, wasn't there?
Laura Linney, isn't she like Virginia Mayo? And I just said, I don't really think so. And then he goes, oh, okay, then when you see Virginia Mayo, who do you think of? And I just said blankly, Virginia Mayo. And it really annoyed Julio that I did not agree with his hypothesis that Laura Linney and Virginia Mayo are two very similar actresses, just from different times. And I'm like, I didn't buy into that. And I always think of Laura Linney as this person that is being forced down my throat to be Virginia Mayo. And then when I'm asked, well, who's Virginia Mayo? Well, she's Virginia Mayo. I've seen Virginia Mayo in many things, and she's always Virginia. She's, what do you mean?
You're really virtue signaling, Ryan.
The question should be, is Laura Linney, who's she remind you of? Well, Virginia Mayo.
No, it's Laura Linney.
No, it's Laura Linney. And I like, you know, LL. She's like a comic book.
Ooh, LL, just like from that anime I read.
Oh. But Rachel has a film to give us. It better not be one we've covered already on the pod.
I'm nervous about that. Now I'm not too sure.
We've already done a Urutsuki Dojo, The Legend of the Demon.
She was there, so she knows.
Maybe so she forgot. I walked in here with a pick, but now I'm second guessing that pick.
Okay.
So, Ryan, what should I go with?
Bartek, what do you think Rachel should go with?
Go with the pick you walked in with.
Repo?
Repo, you have to say.
Repo, the Genetic Opera?
We haven't done that, no.
Yeah, okay.
It is a year of musicals.
That is why I...
Ryan, you're the only one that hasn't recommended a musical yet.
Rachel's really reducing the number of them now. Repo, the Genetic Opera is a film. It's a movie musical. It is an opera, so most of it is told through song.
Mm-hmm.
So keep that in your mind for when you're watching it, Bartek.
Paris Hilton's on brand again. So, okay.
Paris Hilton stars in this, and mm-hmm. as does the little girl from Spy Kids, and a myriad of other people that mm-hmm. will shock and delight and maybe surprise. But Anthony's we'll be talking about Repo, the Genetic Delicious. Opera next time. Some stories to share about that. I have some interesting tales. So everyone make sure to give that a watch in the meantime. Rachel, thank you for coming on and talking to us for our 400th episode. Spectacular. We're now married.
Yes.
All three of us to each other. This was the ceremony. Rachel just said, yes, that's how I do. Yes for me. Bartek, it's a yes.
I'll take it.
Like a slice of pizza that fell on the ground. Well,
the priest says, do you take this, you know, thing?
Thing.
I'll take it. I can do it.
There's only a little bit of hair on the pizza. It's fine. Just brush it off. Everyone make sure to give our podcast a rating and a review. Follow us on whatever social medias you use. Of course, we are on Facebook and Twitter. Those are the ones that we use. But if you find us on some other one, like MySpace, let us know. I want to know if we're there. I haven't checked.
We'll have some words for Tom.
I was going to say, is Tom still there? I hope he's okay.
I'm pretty sure he said he likes Facebook.
Buddy, are you okay? Hey, wouldn't it be great if through AI, MySpace resurges because it's the one platform that's not using it? Because all these social media sites are now using AI on everything. And MySpace is like the one bastion of hope where we are no longer oppressed by our Skynet overlords. But thank you all for being here. Thank you for those who have listened to our many journeys along the way. There's a couple of you, I imagine, that maybe have been here since the start. Not even Rachel has gone through the catalog.
No, I've not listened to every single episode, but I'm excited to hear what your plans are for our honeymoon.
Our honeymoon? Well, that's their 500th episode, and you'll have to really see what we're doing for that one.
Well, it's going to be a Paul Giamatti film.
But we got married now. Why do we have to wait 100 episodes?
Well, Rachel, because honeymoon is that important.
Rachel.
The honeymoon is over.
Rachel, have you already forgotten that I'm part of this wedding too, this marriage?
Yeah.
Let Bartek decide where we go.
No, I don't want to go to Poland.
Neither do I.
Guess what, guys? We're going there because it's a lovely Polish surprise.
Polish surprise. By the way, unlike these two, I recommend the film.